Hey everyone, this is Dennis, one of the co-hosts of Fate's Wide Wheel. Before we jump into today's episode, we just wanted to make the note, this episode is being released 2 days after the mass shooting in Las Vegas. We recorded this episode a couple of weeks ago, and there's nothing in the episode that really talks about the kind of violence that we saw 2 days ago. We do talk about violence in general in TV and movies, but even though we're just a silly little podcast about an old cult sci-fi TV show with a small listenership, simply we just felt it inappropriate to release today's episode without making some kind of comment or acknowledging what happened a couple of days ago. You know, it's been said, you know, thoughts and prayers in times like these only go so far, but for what it's worth, we just wanted to acknowledge the event and just say that our thoughts are with the families and the victims and everyone affected by this tragedy. Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy the show today.
Welcome to Fate's Wide Wheel, a Quantum Leap podcast with Sam and Dennis. We are coming to you from our top secret headquarters at Project Quantum Leap, but you can find us online at fwwquantumleappod.com or follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Fate's Wide Wheel. And please do us a favor by hitting the subscribe button on iTunes.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to this week's episode of Fate's Wide Wheel. I am Dennis.
I'm Sam.
And this week we're covering The Right Hand of God. The leap date is October 24th, 1974. The original air date was Friday, April the 7th, 1989. It was written by John Hill, directed by Gilbert Shilton. And the TV Guide summation of this episode is, somebody up there apparently doesn't like Sam, as he leaps into a glass-jawed boxer whose contract is owned by two nuns hoping to finance a chapel for the poor. And as we covered in last week's episode, when Sam leaps in, he is punched to the floor of the boxing ring by a boxer. And as the referee starts to count him out, his coach is encouraging a confused Sam to try to get up from the mat.
Yeah.
So we were talking about this off mic before. You, Sam, apparently have a lot of feelings about this episode.
I do. So I want to say a couple of things right off the bat before we dive too deep into that, because I feel like it'll honestly take up the bulk of our conversation. Thing one, there's no oh boy moment in this episode at all. There is also no quote for Al this week that I have, which will play into the bulk of the discussion, or a portion of that discussion, mm-hmm. I believe. One of the issues that I have with this episode on the whole, and this is usually the type of stuff I think we talk about at the end of the episode, but I'm going to talk about it right now, is compared to the last episode where we got a very good overall story and plot that held together well, mm-hmm. and I felt like had a lot of intersecting moments, both between what was happening in the 1990s with Al and what was happening in the 1972 scenario with Sam and Donna, and you know, everything held together really well. This plot feels so overloaded. There is so much going on. There are so many secondary characters. There are so many subplots. And I don't mean that to sound like, oh, there's 20, 50, 100 or whatever. No, there's not. But in a 47 minute block of television where we're telling a story about a man who leaps in, has to set something right, and then leaps out, there's way too much going on for me to care about any one of them in particular. Especially when, you know, you have a couple of characters that are clearly supposed to mean a lot, and I feel like don't get the time on screen to mean anything to me other than what I'm told they're supposed to mean to me. Mm-hmm. You know, looking at the screenwriter's career, he wrote Little Nikita, which is a film that I'm a fan of with mm-hmm. River Phoenix and Sidney Poitier. It's a very, very good movie. Other than that, not a lot doing that I noticed. Take that for what you will. But let's go ahead and dive into the episode, okay. Dissect it.
I will give the counterpoint to dive in. And this is a thought that came actually when I was rewatching how the test was won, but I'll throw it here into this episode because I think it applies, is that when I was younger watching these episodes,
I did not like a lot of the first season either, just because it didn't seem a lot of high stakes compared to stories that
right.
come up
yes.
in the later seasons.
Mm-hmm.
But to not give too many spoilers away about future episodes, is that starting with the second season, we get a lot more episodes where Sam is there to prevent someone from getting killed, or for someone meeting some kind of, if not violent, and some kind of violent or very unfortunate
yeah.
situation. As I get older, the last few years, and especially in the last few months, since finding out that me and my wife are having a child, and having a child, I've become very averse to TV shows that have a violent thread to them.
Mm-hmm.
Like right now, Betsy and I are trying to get into Game of Thrones, mm. and I'm finding it very hard to get into
yeah.
because. But it came for me like I want to say like 3 or 4 years ago. Like I realized like I was really into Sons of Anarchy for a while,
mm-hmm.
and like towards the end, I just had to stop watching it.
Yeah,
because I don't know if you ever watched that.
Yep.
Show. It's just like every episode. Not only did they kill someone off, but they had to show it in the most graphic way possible.
Yeah,
Breaking Bad got that way towards the end, and so
yeah.
And so I've gotten to a point with shows yeah. where like episode plots like these, where there are stakes, but they're not as deep. No one necessarily meets a violent end. I say in an episode that revolves around boxing,
right?
But it's an episode of TV that I can just kind of sit back and enjoy, and it's not violent. And because of that, I appreciate episodes like these more now than I did when I was younger.
You know, to add to that real quick, I think that Right Hand of God, the next episode we'll talk about how the test was won, and the episode after that, Double Identity. All three of those episodes, I think, qualify with what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
The other two, in spite of things that I'm not on board with, work much better as an hour-long episode of television than this one does, though.
Okay. That is fair.
I feel like The Right Hand of God could have been a 90-minute teleplay as opposed to a 47-minute, with all of the stuff that's there.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you want me to just talk explicitly about what I'm talking about, or if we want to go scene by scene.
So in case if you're catching up and you've never seen this episode, or it's been a while since you've seen the episode, so Sam leaps in and he gets knocked to the mat. He's almost counted out, but then he's able to get back up. And he obviously doesn't know what he's doing. I think he may throw a couple of weak punches. The other boxer like kind of corners him, is punching it, and Sam just makes like a flailing move.
Yeah, and barely hits him,
and the boxer's out.
Yeah.
He is done, and Sam's just kind of standing there.
Well, he like, apologizes.
This great moment, like, hey man, I'm sorry. There's a great moment of like, what the hell just happened, and then we make our way into the locker room. And to make a long story short, before we introduce a couple of the other characters that come in, it becomes very clear between his coach and his ring man that Sam makes a comment that, man, I barely touched that guy and he went down. What happened? And it's very clear by the way they react, like, he's a boxer on the take.
Yeah.
The other guy took a dive.
Yeah. And Gomez, who is the corner man, mm-hmm. Played by Alex Colon, we get a lot from him without dialogue, which is nice.
Mm-hmm.
And I like him a lot in this episode, actually. And to be frank, it is one of the reasons why I have my comment about too much going on, because we don't get a lot of him, unfortunately,
mm-hmm.
Or as much as I would like, I think, because he is a good character, and stuff that happens later reinforces that, and I think that the performance holds together well, and the interactions he has with Sam are great. Something else that I want to mention that's interesting to me is that Sam gets busted open in his eyebrow. He's got a cut, and Sam has the cut.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it kind of reinforces the fact that that when Sam leaps, you know, it's his physical presence that is there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he maintains his aura of the other person or whatever, but physically it's Sam Beckett.
Mm-hmm.
So Sam's cut, you know, Sam mm-hmm. is bleeding.
Mm-hmm.
It's not,
in this
know,
first shot, we do get the first mirror shot of the episode. We get a pretty sustained cut.
Yeah.
A pretty sustained shot.
That's right, we do.
Of this guy.
Of Cody, yeah.
Exactly.
something that gets mentioned a little bit later on, but is also kind of mentioned here, that's funny to me, is that he's a heavyweight. He's supposed to be a heavyweight boxer. Mm-hmm. This guy is not a heavyweight boxer. 185 pounds, it's not a heavyweight boxer.
Because I was saying it like this as we went on, like, I know, like, I wrestled in high school.
Yeah.
And in wrestling, at least at the high school level, and I think this is pretty much the same for the collegiate level, anything above 189 is heavyweight.
Okay.
And so that's something that struck me, like, looking at all of the boxers in this episode, including Kid Cody Tiger Joe at the end of the episode, his opponent, even he looks pretty small, and it's a heavyweight match.
Yeah, because it's generally over 200 pounds. Is what a lot of the boxing federations and organizations, mm-hmm. all the myriad ones that are out there these days, say. But, you know, that's neither here nor there, because it's TV, it's fiction, it's a picture of a picture, so whatever.
Mm. I will say, I'll argue at this point, I don't think at this point in the series they've made it clear that whether it's Sam's body that's sleeping or whether Sam's mind. That is sleeping. It is interesting to note in one interview that Don Bellisario gave where they talk about injuries and everything. You know, he had made the argument that, you know, the way I see it, like, if Sam leaps into someone with a broken leg, Sam doesn't have a broken leg.
Yeah.
If Sam gets his leg broken in a leap,
right,
Sam has a broken leg.
Yes.
And so it's like, so yeah, he got hit in this first few moments. So yes, yeah. He has the cut.
Yeah. Yeah. Which it was just something that I noticed, you know, in the context of kind of, as we're starting the podcast, clearly doing a lot of reading about Quantum Leap and talking mm-hmm. about Quantum Leap and having these discussions and going back and remembering some of the big, you know, discussions that took place, you know, in the old days about what is this and, you know, and the debates and that being one of them. And to me, this is kind of an early sign of what you were just talking about with Bellisario going in that direction of that he's leaping physically, you know, mm-hmm. that it's not just his mind, that it's his body as well.
Mm-hmm. So we have the fact that, like I said, we just learned that Kid Cody... he won because the fight was thrown.
Yeah.
And we also learned that this was his last fight with Gomez. And then we have the introduction of two characters, Sister Angela.
And Sister Sarah.
And Sister Sarah, yes. Now me, just because from TV shows I watched growing up, I don't know if you recognize Sister Sarah, but it's the same actress who played Mrs. Hathaway on the Beverly Hillbillies. From that old TV series.
Oh my gosh, I did not recognize that at all. Yes. Yeah. Nancy Culp is her name. This is one of her last performances.
Her next last role before she passed away from cancer a couple years later. And that's one of those, that's the only other thing I've ever seen that actor in.
Yeah.
Is the Beverly Hillbillies. And so and that's what I always recognize her as.
Well, and Sister Angela is played by Michelle Joyner. And I don't know, honestly, much else about her career.
The only other thing I've seen her in, she is in the opening moments of the Sylvester Stallone movie, Cliffhanger. Spoiler alert, she does not live.
Well.
Basically, she is a plot device. She's someone who dies mountain climbing, I believe, and Sylvester Stallone almost saves her, but she ends up dying. And basically, she is the plot device at the beginning of the movie that informs why Sylvester Stallone is the way he is for the rest of that.
Okay. Well, she, you know, apparently she also did an episode of Millennium and The X-Files as well. So, okay. You know, some other genre television work out there.
Exactly. So we get, in this first scene, we are introduced to this idea that, in some way, that is... Honestly, it's never really clearly explained throughout the episode, which maybe kind of speaks to what your complaints you said earlier, is somehow that Sister Angela and Sister Sarah's convent has inherited Kid Cody's contract from somebody.
It gets sort of summed up in a way that I guess Cody's old manager mm-hmm. left all of his stuff to the church.
That's it. Okay.
And so as a part of it, they inherit his contract, so they basically own Kid Cody.
It doesn't really matter.
No.
Plot device has made Kid Cody the property of the nuns.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then it's interesting because to me, we talked about it briefly last episode as well, but we've had a lot of discussions as to, you know, what it is that's leaping Sam around. Mm-hmm. It's a discussion that will continue, but to have a you know, an actual sort of literal representation of God in this episode by way of the nuns. It creates for some interesting moments of dialogue.
Absolutely. Before we go, I want to jump back to something that you said in the last episode where you thought maybe it was kind of telling that Sam messed with history in a personal way and that he leaps into someone getting punched at the beginning. I don't know if you paid attention to the dialogue at the beginning of this episode, because early on in the series, Sam kind of narrates the events of the last episode into the next episode. And which, if you've watched this episode only in reruns, you don't get that. They edit that out in reruns now. But there's a moment where Sam, in summing up the events of the last episode, he flat out says something to the effect of...
The big guy upstairs would understand.
Maybe the big guy upstairs understand. Pop. Then again,
maybe he didn't. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So that's interesting. I don't know if we'll do it on this episode, but in one of these early episodes, we should insert what the opening narration
sounds like
in these early episodes.
Yes.
Because, like we said before, if you've only caught the show in reruns...
You did not get
this. They always take the opening narration that was established in the first run, like later in season two. And they use that for the entire series.
Yeah. So if you're watching on Hulu, that's what you're getting, the later stuff. If you're watching the Blu-rays that recently came out this past year, that is the original as aired episode. So you'll get the original opening saga cell.
Yeah. So let's just say that for the purposes of this episode right now, we're going to insert in, like, this is what the opening narration sounded like as it originally aired, and what you see now, like if you bought the DVDs or the Blu-rays.
It all started when a time travel experiment I was conducting went a little caca. In the blink of a cosmic clock, I went from quantum physicist to Air Force test pilot, which could have been fun if I knew how to fly. Fortunately, I had help. An observer from the project named Al. Unfortunately, Al's a hologram, so all he can lend is moral support. Anyway, here I am, bouncing around in time, putting things right that once went wrong, a sort of time-traveling Lone Ranger with Al as my Tonto. And I don't even need a mask.
So yeah, as you can tell, it's Sam, you know, it's Sam talking kind of very matter-of-factly. It's not, it's fairly direct, and it leads into,
the events of that.
Yeah. It kind of helps to sum up what's come before and then leads you into this next. And I wonder on a purely practical standpoint, is this their way of helping to sell the new TV series? Like, we've got a new viewer coming in that didn't see the pilot in the episode before, and now we're kind of helping to set things up and capsule it real quickly. Is it?
Absolutely. And I feel like another great Quantum Leap podcast, Back to the Future, they've pointed this out before, is that throughout the entire run of the series, a good 3-4 minutes is dedicated every episode to introducing you to the concept of the series. There's the opening narration. And then there's the theme song, which goes on for a couple minutes, which gives you a lot of telling clips of Sam looking in the mirror and seeing someone else
walking
through stuff, these kind of action shots. I feel it was very clear that the producers of the series they wanted to make sure that anybody catching an episode for the first time, they wanted them to understand what the premise of the series
absolutely
was about.
Yeah, and I think that it does, you know, it does help. And it's interesting watching them, you know, with sort of fresh eyes in a way, having not seen a lot of these episodes in over 10 years for me personally, and feeling that it makes it feel, because it's very different from a lot of what you get in modern television. So it feels... I don't want to say antiquated, but it feels old school. You know, there's something about it that feels different.
I remember reading a thing, I want to say it was like the late 90s, early 2000s. It was an Entertainment Weekly article talking about, like, this move away from opening theme songs.
Yeah.
And it was, I don't know if cynical is the right word, but it was very much a thing that all networks were doing, because theme songs were just an opportunity for the viewer to change the channel and go watch something else.
Yeah.
So the late 90s, early 2000s, across the board in television, there was this very deliberate move to start taking the opening theme songs out of shows and just mm-hmm. dive straight
in. Just jump right in. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and even today, you know, if you're watching TV on Netflix, for instance, a lot of times they basically have the option where it jumps past the credits.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're binge watching something, they'll lop the credits off and just starts
where they're previously on.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So yeah, it's a great device, obviously, to expose it to new viewers. At the time, I think it probably felt very right, and it worked. It's interesting seeing it again, having not seen it in a while. And giving us the intro into this particular episode based on what the pilot and Starcross did, it sets it up nicely for that. The big guy upstairs understood, bam, popped in the face. Oh, maybe he didn't. Mm-hmm. And now getting the nuns walking in, you know, religion is in the house, literally. Mm-hmm. And you know, Sam has this wonderful moment with Sister Angela that I really, really like, because to me, it's almost, it's almost Sam talking to God and God talking to Sam in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And this is colored a little bit by the fact that one of the books that we've been using for reference and as a guiding light, Beyond the Mirror Image, in his sort of end of the episode review, he talks about them having tiptoed around the concept of God, and now this is embracing the concept wholeheartedly.
They just lean in full bore.
I don't know that I completely agree with that, to be honest with you, which is something we'll talk about later.
With them doing it or with his evaluation?
With his evaluation of it. But in this moment, I think it is interesting in that context, because one of the things that does happen is that Sam has this line to Sister Angela about, don't count on me too much. And, you know, she responds with, like, I am counting on you. And there's this nice little element of, yeah, that's Sam talking to Angela and Angela talking to Sam. But on another level, I think there's a subtext of Sam saying,
talking to a higher
power. I don't know if I can do this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at this point, he's leapt, what, three times?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we got Tom Stratton, we got Tim Fox, and we got Dr. Gerald Bryant.
Mm-hmm.
And in those three leaps, we've seen some interesting things happen, quite frankly, for mm-hmm. him. And I think that now he's sitting there, he's like, I don't know, you know, I don't know if I can do this. And now this nun is looking at him saying, no, I know you can do it, and I'm counting on you to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting little moment. And when I watched the episode this last time, it hit me in that subtextual level of Sam, you know, holding Congress with a higher power, and the higher power looking down on him and saying, I'm counting on you. Mm-hmm. You know, I need you,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was really interesting.
For sure. So to jump back and say, like, what Sister Angela is counting on him for?
Oh, right. Yeah.
The next scene, no. Yeah. The next scene after we get out of the locker room, they're walking, almost like this parking lot, this mm-hmm. vacant lot. And Sister Angela is explaining that, like, this is where the future chapel is going to be, that she has a dream of building, and that this is going to be funded by Kid Cody winning his next fight. And you find out that Kid Cody has won his last 10 bouts.
Yeah.
And because of the events of the last scene, you have to wonder, did he win these because the fights were thrown?
Yeah. And now we find out not only that his next match is the championship match.
Yes.
Yeah. And so Sam immediately kind of says to Al, like, okay, hey, I know what I'm here to do.
Yeah.
I got to win this championship match.
Well, I love, because Angela says it's all going according to God's plan, and Al shows up like, well, it's not going according to Ziggy's plan.
Yeah.
This next loop was supposed to land you in Texas somewhere.
As a farmer in the 50s,
yeah,
or something.
In the mid-50s. And it's an interesting thing to not give a heavy spoiler away from the future, is that early on in the series, they were kind of playing with this fact that Ziggy was kind of tracking Sam's leaps, mm-hmm. like where he was supposed to wind up, which is something they got away from in later episodes.
Yeah. Well, and another thing that's interesting too at this point, because of the way that the episodes have played out, and as we know, they did technically air out of order. Now, it was intentional. It wasn't like some television programs like Firefly, for instance, or that show Almost Human from a couple of years back, where they aired them out of order almost unintentionally, and it messed with the continuity of the show. This was more of sort of an idea where it's like, no, we are going to air this out of order. We're doing it on purpose. So the leaps in and out work. They, you know, the overall context of the episode works.
Mm-hmm.
But that being said, I think something interesting that happens there is We get 1956 as Tom Stratton. We get 1968 as Tim Fox. We get 1972 as Dr. Gerald Bryant. And now here we are in 1974 as Kid Cody. So it's again, whether intentional or not, he's leaping towards the future. He's not yet leapt backwards in time from a leap that he's already gone on, which is kind of interesting. He's progressing forward. Mm-hmm. So the fact that Ziggy's like, oh, I had him placed in the 50s in Texas as a farmer, it's interesting for two reasons. One, yeah, Ziggy's tracking him and trying to figure out where he's going to land. And two, he keeps going forward. And three, spoiler alert, we find out with the next episode that he does end up in Texas in the mid-50s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this was interesting. Unscheduled stop, as Ziggy points out. So they have this moment. Go ahead.
Sorry, I got to mention this one other thing, because Jess, who's not here for this episode, my wife Jessica, who's guested on our last two episodes, one of the things that both of us immediately couldn't get over is Al's jacket.
That is a loud
jacket. Yeah, that jacket is something
I don't
else.
Feel like Al hit his stride with his outfits.
Until this episode,
No, not even that. Like, all of his outfits, like, it's a very loud jacket, but it's very loose-fitting, and a lot of his stuff is very blousy and loose-fitting.
Yeah.
And by saying Al, I should say, like, the costume designers on the show. Yeah. Like, I feel like season 3, season 4, and some of season 2, like, his outfits are on point.
Yeah.
A lot of these outfits in this first season just kind of hang off of him.
Yeah, I would argue that the episode that he wears in the final scene of this episode is, like,
yes,
prototypical Al.
Yes, yeah. And even the one before. But yeah, this first outfit is...
Yeah, something else, that copper jacket.
So we find out that they are... he's in Sacramento, California.
Yep.
In the 1974.
Yeah, 1974, yeah. October 24th.
October 20th, yeah, 1974. And so in this first scene, yeah, we find out basically, like, Sam is supposed to have this prize fight and win. And Al's story of this episode, we talked about this last episode, like, early on, they don't really know what to do with Al. So Al's subplot in this episode is the neighbor with the muffler from hell who insists on doing car work in the middle of the night, keeping Al awake. And so we have this comedic moment where Al goes to sleep on a piece of cardboard
right in front
of
the couch. And I hate it.
Which is great, because from a production standpoint, it's really great. Like, they put a piece of cardboard down so that Dean Stockwell doesn't get dirty.
Yeah.
So that Al the hologram doesn't shift the cardboard around. They put a brick down to weigh down the cardboard. And it's also a nice thing that Dean Stockwell, as an actor, he has to avoid... His hand comes very close to that brick several times during that scene, and he has to avoid it as a hologram. It's
very observant.
Yeah, it's a nice little moment there. That's interesting.
One other thing that happens in this scene that I really, really enjoy, because they're discussing briefly about the raising funding for the church, is that Al gives us a wonderful piece of information that I think reinforces a running theme for these first three episodes, and that is the nature of Sam and Al's relationship.
Exactly, yeah, because we hit the point where Angela leaves, giving them a chance opportunity to talk. And Al
mentions the thing about how they used to stay up late at night, poring over blueprints, figuring out how they were going to raise the money for the project.
And they get to that point, like, who does Angela remind you of? And Sam throws out Ingrid Bergman.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, like, you and me, back in the old days,
right,
trying to raise money. It was like, yeah, it's like this really nice moment where we get insight into their relationship. Because at this point, I don't think it's clearly established how deeply involved Al was with the building of the project up until this point.
No.
But here you clearly get the idea, like Al has been in this from the beginning.
Yeah, I think that, one of the things that is interesting is, Al, he does feel a little nebulous at times. Mm-hmm. And I think that in this episode, we get a moment where, I don't mind it. I think that there's some nitpickers out there that are kind of, they're like, oh, what can Al do this time or this week? You know, what hole can he fill now or whatever? But we'll get to that a little bit later. The thing about Al is that I think that other than getting that he's, an inveterate womanizer. And this idea that in the pilot in particular, he was drinking and partying a bit, struggling here and there or whatever. There's obviously a very close relationship between him and Sam. But we don't get a lot outside of that.
Mm-hmm.
This episode really does start to fill in some of those blanks, though.
Mm-hmm.
We learn shortly hereafter, in fact, we learn that he was an orphan.
Mm-hmm.
He talks about growing up in an orphanage.
Mm-hmm.
We learn some other things about him in this episode. That being said, he doesn't have a lot to do. And him laying down and taking a nap because he's tired because of this stupid subplot where his neighbor's got the carburetor. First of all, it's like, in my mind, he lives in the middle of nowhere, or he lives at the project, because he's in the middle of a desert.
Mm-hmm.
Who's his neighbor?
You kind of get the sense that Al should always be on call.
Yeah.
Like, right at the project.
So so there's parts of it that, to me, I'm not on board with. I don't like the fact that, again, he doesn't get left with a lot to do. He does get one of my favorite Al moments so far in the series, which we'll get to a little bit later. But for the most part, I'm not on board with tired, sleepy Al over...
It's definitely weird. It's a plot. So we move on from this scene, and Al, or Sam, I should say, he gets back to his home, which I guess at this point, like, he's become very adept at, like, looking at his wallet and figuring out his address or some kind of key thing or something. But as he's going up to his apartment, a car pulls up, and clearly, who is supposed to be some sort of form of a henchman, gets out and like, "Hey, Mr. Edwards wants to talk to you. Come down here."
Yes.
And so we get pulled into the scene. So Mr. Edwards, we talked about this off mic before we recorded, is Guy Stockwell, Dean Stockwell's older brother.
Yeah.
By 3 years. When I was looking up information on him, back in the day, he was a very dapper looking man, very much like Dean Stockwell. And somewhere along the way, that clearly changed. Like, if I would not know just from his looks that him and, like, in that picture you just pulled up on IMDb right there, I could buy him and Dean Stockwell as brothers. But later in life, I would have not put that two together unless I was clearly told.
I completely agree.
And we were talking about it off mic later. Guy Stockwell, he passed away a few years later while...
2002, February 6th,
2002, while Dean Stockwell and Scott Bakula were filming an episode of Enterprise, which Dean Stockwell guest starred, which was actually the first time that they worked together after Quantum Leap ended, some years later.
Yeah, I mean, it had been about eight, 9 years since mm-hmm. they worked together. And see, this scene, it starts the issue that I had with the episode at the very top of the show, and that's that we're getting so much thrown at us. And I can keep track of it all. It's not a case of me being, like, incapable of keeping track of all these subplots and characters that they're adding in. But, you know, it's not yet too much, but it's getting there. Because now we have his, you know, this crooked mob boss with his henchmen throwing Sam in the car, you know, congratulating him on his fight, joking around with him. Sam's starting to get the picture, it dawning on him that, oh, the fights have been thrown, all that, you know, and Sam being like, oh, you know, maybe I just won't fight, and being threatened. And, you know, Sam has the moment where he quotes on the waterfront, it could have been a contender, Marlon Brando impersonation. Mm. It's actually a halfway decent Brando.
It is. And that highlights how more comedic Scott Bakula played Sam in the early episodes.
Yeah.
Like doing those kind of little bits.
Oh, this episode, I think that early comedic strain is in full effect, and we're going to get to another moment that I'm like, what is going on?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You can't see this at home, but smoke is nearly coming out of Sam's ears. So in this scene, we find out that Kid Cody is definitely on the take. And he is going to lose the title match.
Yes.
And Mr. Edwards stands to make a lot of money on it. And it's also a nice moment where we turn on the radio and we know that there is an upcoming fight between Muhammad Ali and
George Foreman.
And it's interesting, like, the respect that Mr. Edwards has for real boxing, the real sport. Like, that's the real thing. Two men fighting it out. You're going to take a dive in the first.
This isn't the Rumble in the Jungle.
Weird, twisted sense of honor and dignity. Like, yeah, those are real fighters. You're a chump. And you're going to take a dive in the first round.
Yeah.
So then we go upstairs and we meet Dixie.
Oh, Dixie. Terry Copley. Hmm. Copley? Hmm. Do we know? I don't know. I'm sorry, Terry. Yeah, we meet Dixie, and Dixie is a voluptuous Marilyn Monroe look-alike and sound-alike.
Mm-hmm.
Or rather the character that Marilyn Monroe often portrayed. One could certainly argue that that wasn't who she was in a day-to-day, sure. But anyway, which I just had another thought, which would spoil things for later in the show, but so I'm not going to say it. Dixie is... The thing about it, I feel like she's played in a way that she doesn't feel as over the top as Jamie Lee, for instance, in the last episode. There's something grounded about her. There's something kind of naive about her and sweet about her. While at the same time, she's seen some stuff, you know, she's been around that block. Mm-hmm. But I like her. I really do. But all of a sudden, we're introduced to this donut shop idea. You're going to make the money to buy us the donut shop, and we're going to do this. I'm going to make
the dream. Yeah, the dream for the future, and the little money that Cody's won is going to go towards that. And then we're introduced to I can't remember the character's name.
Roscoe.
That's his name.
Roscoe, yeah.
So Roscoe shows up, and apparently Kid Cody had made some side bet on horse racing somewhere else, and he lost. Three C notes, $300.
Yeah, so he owes some money to this local bookie.
On that one. But I love, there's the great, the comedic moment in there where she opens the door, is like, you know, if you get between me and Glazed and Jelly Filled ever again, that's it.
Yeah.
Glazed and Jelly Filled ever again. I'm going to break your nose, throw some money on the ground, slams the door in his face, and then we hear, you broke my nose.
Yeah.
Which is a great little comedic moment that.
Right.
Like, you don't get a lot of the later episodes.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm fine with it. But then there's this moment where, like, the Amazing Grace moment.
For sure. So Sam throws out the idea that he has to go move in with the nuns to help save money, which is another plot point that
doesn't really explain very well.
But yeah, she's like, you'd rather go live with nuns than with me.
And she takes off her clothes.
And I can't remember the line, but she's like, but I thought that you belong to me, and I belong to you. And she takes off her robe, and Sam is face to face with...
That's almost exactly what she says.
With Amazing Grace.
Yes.
And that transitions us into the next scene.
And he's laying back, and he's singing some of Amazing Grace at one point. And it's actually the first time we get Sam singing.
So it's this transition of him moving in and finding his bed.
And he leans back.
In the church with the boxing ring and supplies already set up. And he lays back and he's singing, which is interrupted by Al snoring.
Yes, because Al apparently has gone into the imaging chamber and just fallen asleep. And now is snoring, and, you know, Sam notices him.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever.
Tell me some more how you feel about this plotline.
It really does bother me, and because it doesn't... Here's the thing. I don't think it works comedically.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it works from any sort of... And look, I'm not saying that everything in this show needs to make sense. It's a guy traveling through time, leaping in and out of people's bodies... keeping his own physical presence, etc., etc., etc. Fine, I get that. At the same time, why on earth is he in the imaging chamber?
Passed out of sleep.
And how did he... Because was he there the whole time? And if he's there the whole time, is he just following Sam around? Was he peeping on Sam while he and Dixie were getting down to business? And he's just falling asleep? Mm-hmm. And if he's falling asleep, does that mean that, like, he basically is following Sam, laying on the ground this whole time, and Sam just doesn't notice him? And now you know, Sam does notice him because he snores? I don't know. It just doesn't make any sense. It renders Al so ineffectual.
Mm-hmm. I feel like this comes from... We are both big fans of Star Trek, and I feel like even going as far back as the original series, like the writer, like they sat down and they figured out like how the science of everything works.
Yeah.
Diving into episodes. Where I really feel like with the writers of Quantum Leap, they were just kind of making up the rules of how everything worked, like how the imaging chamber and
yeah.
like that. They were just making up the rules as they went along. And in the moment, I'm not saying it's the best comedy gag in the world. But this is just a nice, cheap little subplot for Al in this episode. It provides some, you know, for some comedy. As Sam leans over and Al is waking up, he makes it like, Denise, get in the closet. Oh, Tina. So
yeah.
We get the sing of
Al is still cheating. With Tina, but he's cheating on her with Denise.
With Denise, yeah. Who's a writer and is going to write his life story.
Right, going to write his life story. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and I think that because in the last episode, Al's subplot, if you will, played in so well to the overall plot of that particular episode, and also specifically into the relationship with Sam, it just does not work for me in this one. There are other times where it is clear that there are things happening to Al off screen, and it really works, and this is just not one of them for me. It just seems silly and dumb. I don't like it, and I don't understand why they looked at this, and I can't understand unless, again, they just looked at it and like, it'll be a silly gag, let's go with it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only thing. You know, and to me, you know, here we are 28 years on, it just doesn't hold up.
Mm-hmm.
For me.
I hear you.
Yeah. That said...
So we get introduced to this idea that Sam is going to have to train
to win
this match in 3 days. And so Al says that he can help because... Like you said, we find out that he grew up in an orphanage, and then at 16 he was...
A
boxer. And so they have this bit of routine where, you know, Al throws off his jacket, like, come on, I'll show you here.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But it doesn't work, because obviously he's a hologram, and Sam's like, what are you going
to
do?
Mm-hmm.
And
which to me, like, I don't buy that, like, what's wrong with having a hologram to box,
yeah.
I mean, at least to do like some sparring exercises. Like, you got to do some other stuff.
And in our 2017 timeline here, with something like the Wii, for instance, it's like, somebody could totally train with a hologram.
There's even a thing now. I saw this the other day, and this is kind of a tangent, where they have these. I'm not sure what you call them. Like they're like boxing machines, like set up with gyms. Or are you standing for like anywhere like conceivable like. Like a routine, like up here, like by the face, or an uppercut, or off to the side, or whatever. Like they have like all these pads set up,
and the
screen on the machine will like give you like the routine to follow. Okay, punch here, punch here, punch here.
I'd
love to try that out sometime.
Yeah, I know, right? And it's great cardio. Yeah, and one of the things that comes out of this, though, is really honest. It genuinely is one of my favorite Al scenes. And unfortunately, it gets so undercut by the rest of the bullshit that they have Al do in this episode. I mean that. And that's that Sam is just like, you can't help me. Leaves, and he turns out the lights. And Al is left there alone.
In the dark,
and,
yeah.
And it's
and
just
it's a great moment.
Yeah.
Like, at this point, you don't know enough about Al to, like, really know what the subtext is of this. But he just has this moment, like... I was good too.
Yeah.
And referring to boxing. And he just kind of looks after Sam like in this sad way. And it's not justified. I haven't watched this episode in reruns in quite a long time. I am sure that in syndication they cut the scene off.
Yeah, I could imagine that.
But it's just this great little Dean Stockwell moment where he just kind of looks after Sam sadly after having the lights turned off.
It's very loaded, you know. As an acting moment, there's a lot at work there, and I think that it's one, this idea that, like, he has this skill and he can't share it, and he's being dismissed, and it's like, no, hey, I used to be good at this.
Mm-hmm.
There's also that idea that he can't help his best friend, and his best friend really needs his help, and, you know, and I think that it reinforces this loneliness that Al has to feel, that because his best friend is not around, and, and he's filling his nights with Tina's and Denise's and, you know, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But I really like that moment. Next, though, we go on.
He goes off to get an actual trainer. He goes back to find
Gomez. Yeah, in the bar. Two things about this. One, I think Alex Colon continues to play the role really well. Two, there's a Kid Cody poster in the background that I thought was kind of cool.
Ooh, I hadn't noticed that before.
Yeah.
And there's a nice little comedy moment. They make his TKO drink, which I'm not...
Yeah.
I'm not sure what that is. Yeah.
Smoking.
I remember watching that scene as a kid. And I grew up like a very conservative, very religious thing. Like, alcohol is bad, whatever. And so just like watching that scene as a kid, like, oh God, I wouldn't want to drink that.
Yeah.
Rewatching it this time, I was like, I'd be interested in trying
that. Yeah.
What's going on with that?
It might be, yeah, the three dots in the dash in the loop. North Shore, rather, might have a drink like that.
Yeah.
Jessica with her tiki bar there, you know. If you're ever in Chicago, check them out. Great drinks.
For sure. Yeah.
Anyway.
But anyway, so he goes back to Gomez and makes the argument, like, I want you to train her for this fight.
Yeah.
And Gomez says, like, I'm tired of training boxers who take dives.
Yeah. And we get the information here that Gomez at one time was also a boxer.
Because Mr. Edwards shows up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And also took some dives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because Mr. Edwards shows up and he basically kind of rubs Gomez's face.
Right.
In the proverbial poop.
Yep.
It's like, this guy, he should get an Oscar. He can
he
could take a dive better than anyone. You know, so on and so forth. And then we see another thing on TV about the upcoming Muhammad Ali.
Yep.
Form and fight. We also get a thing on the news about
Watergate.
Watergate, which is a nice tie-in. And someone on the news has been streaking.
Oh,
yeah, because they make some thing.
That's right.
They make some thing about that. So this makes three episodes in a row where streaking is referenced.
Yep.
It's referenced in the pilot, as Sam having done in college. It doesn't get mentioned in Star-Crossed, but we come back to streaking yet again, which is a very big thing in the 70s.
Right.
Ray Stevens had an entire song around it. Anyway.
Well, yeah, it's great because the television continues to be, and you know, one could even make some sort of meta argument about this, I'm sure, because we're watching a TV show, but the television tends to be a way that we're getting information about when and where we are.
Absolutely.
And giving us that context. In this instance, not only does it do that, but it also sets up two specific plot points,
mm-hmm.
actually.
Yeah.
So now, you know, Gomez is you know, ends up getting convinced after, because wait, hang on, where are we in the episode?
Yeah,
remind
because,
me, you're
because
better at this than
it,
that.
It was the fact that Mr. Edwards rubs his face in the dirt about taking dives. That's the, like, the Marty McFly chicken moment.
Yes,
that makes Gomez turn to Cody and say, "Are you serious?
Yeah.
You want a trainer? You got a trainer.
I train you." Yeah, we start the training.
Training montage.
Well, we don't get to the montage just yet, because first he has him spar
right.
with the father.
The father, yes. So yeah, it's a nice little moment. And this was a weird production thing that I've never noticed before, where Sam asks Gomez for any advice, and Gomez says, "Try not to trip over his beard."
Yeah.
Implying that the father has a beard. The father's clean shaven.
Yeah, yeah. I don't understand.
And that was just
it
like, well, clearly the father was originally written to have a beard,
and
the actor they cast didn't, and they just never bothered to change that line.
The actor is Louis Arquette, and if that last name sounds familiar, it's because he is indeed the father of Patricia, Alexis, Rosanna, David, and Richmond Arquette.
Interesting.
And indeed the father-in-law for a time of Courtney Cox.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, a famous family there. He, it's interesting because going back to that metaphor between God and Sam, they get in the ring, and obviously there's this, don't hurt the father, you know, whereas Sister Angela's saying, no, he's just pleased as punch to be in the ring with you. It'll be fun for him. He'll be thrilled to tell everybody that he was in the ring.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, what proceeds to happen is Sam gets trounced by the father. Has no boxing ability whatsoever.
Absolutely. What I love about this short fight that happens is that the actor who plays Sister Angela, she just has these great, like, physical comedy moments where she's like ringside, like throwing punches, and just how awkward she looks throwing those punches. Going back to the first scene where she has the line like, "That last punch in the last inning."
Oh yeah, last inning.
It was inspired. Yeah.
And then now,
Sister Angela is not written as the deepest character, but I think that actor, she does a lot with the role that she's given.
I agree. And actually, before we get to what I was going to say, now we get your training montage. Totally Rocky, right down to the theme music. He's going all out. He's training. Two things about this. We're supposed to believe he does all of this within the span of about 4 or 5 days.
Actually, 3 days.
Okay, yeah. So even less.
Mm-hmm.
Take that for what you will. But he's clearly getting better. He's sweating a lot. He's doing the jump rope. He's boxing. He learns how to do the speed bag, when at first he just kind of stares at it, doesn't understand it at all.
But also from a production standpoint, I mean, just think about it in terms of a TV show.
Mm-hmm.
Scott Bakula was told about this episode like maybe one or two episodes
before.
And like, even reading the thing, like, he trained to box.
He did.
During his lunch
hours,
filming other episodes.
Yeah. In fact, he was quoted as saying, "They'd bring a guy who trained heavyweight fighters and he'd put me through the heavyweight fight." And so he'd put him through the drills. He'd be jumping rope, working on the heavy bag, working the speed bag, doing the sparring,
sure,
the whole nine yards. So, yeah, I mean, it paid off because he does. He ends up looking great. Now, I mean, they focus mostly on the upper body stuff, so it would be interesting to see the footwork because, you know, anybody that knows anything about boxing knows that that's really where it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he gets a little bit of that, obviously, later on when we get to the actual fight. The next scene, it comes out of the training montage, though, is a nice scene between Sister Angela and Sam. Mm-hmm. So this brings me to two things. One, I agree with you. I like what Sister Angela, I like who she is, you know, I like mm-hmm. what the actor does. I really liked this scene. She has a monologue here that mm-hmm. kind of explains why Sister Angela is the way she is, where she's coming from. Mm-hmm. My better half, Jessica, did not.
Mm-hmm. See, in fact, it was just occurred to me, like we've talked about previous episodes, like you transcribed part of one episode for your high school thing, and I transcribed part of an episode for another thing. Somewhere out there, there's a female fan of Quantum Leap that took this monologue from this episode.
Absolutely.
And she presented it in some high school or college monologue class. If you're out there listening, write into us.
Please do, yes. Find us at Fate's Wide Wheel on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting because I really like... I will admit that it gets a little bit melodramatic at the end. You know, she starts to milk it a little bit, sure. But for the most part, she plays it very straight, and I really enjoy the early part of it. So, yeah, her monologue is fairly interesting to me in that not only does it give us some exposition, but I think it also, you know, is just a great emotional moment for who this person is. And I think Sam is clearly touched by what she has to say. And what she has to say mm-hmm. is that... her family died in a fire when she was a young girl, and she was taken in by the nuns, lived in an orphanage, grew up in the orphanage, but she was, you know, very poor, and that now she's vowed to build this chapel as a shrine to not only commemorate her family, but so that other destitute people can look towards it for inspiration and faith.
But also, she feels that God spared her specifically for some reason.
Yes.
Which plays into more to what you're saying, like this episode really leans heavy into the God thing.
Yeah, it does. And I think that, you know, one other thing that I want to mention, and it's a fine line, because obviously Cody has Dixie, and Sam, you know, has already had his moment with Dixie, if you will, to the point that there was actually a line apparently in the original script that had Sam singing the first few lines of the song Dixie, which, if people don't know them, is, you know, I wish I was in Dixie.
Somewhere, they made a smart choice.
Yeah, somebody was smart about that one. But he clearly has this relationship established with Dixie. That said, I feel like there is definitely a danger because of the nature of the relationship between Sam and Sister Angela, that in spite of the fact that she's a nun, that we're going to get one of those stories of, like, you know... the nun falls for the guy and decides to ditch the habit.
I just realized? There is not a single scene in this episode where Al and Dixie are together.
Oh, wow.
And Dixie...
is Al's type.
Dixie is perfectly Al's type. Again, this speaks to, at this point, they didn't really know what to do with Al yet.
Well, especially on this episode.
Because in an alternate writing of this episode, there is a scene where Al is singing... I wish I wasn't Dixie.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And especially, like, if Al had been there when she takes her dress off.
Yeah. Yeah.
What the one-liners that would have come out of Al, you know?
Absolutely.
But, so we get this touching monologue.
And, Sister Angela.
With Sister Angela. And there's a nice moment between the two of them. I think that Sam becomes even more committed to, you know, to winning this fight and getting them the money. Now, you know, we're back with Al telling Sam in the next scene that...
So we're back in the gym.
Yeah.
And we're in the end of this montage, like, we found that Sam is much better at everything. Everything he was failing at the beginning of the montage, he's doing great at.
He's, you know...
Jump rope, bag work.
He's a savant. He's a real Renaissance man.
Yes.
And one thing that I found interesting is that Sam not knowing how to fight, and with what we learn about Sam... later on, is that I don't know if that holds true for the Sam that we learn about later in the series.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to hear that he doesn't know how to fight. Mm-hmm. So now they're back in the gym. Al tells him that Cody took the dive originally.
Mm-hmm. But to go back to your favorite storyline in this episode, almost as an aside, Sam throws a suggestion to Al how to deal with the loud neighbor by... recording him working on his car and then playing it back at night.
Sure.
Sure.
Why not?
Yeah.
The thing is at this point, I think I
picture even in that moment of filming Scott Bakula going, what the hell is this?
Yeah. I think at this moment, the thing too, is that we have the nuns, we have Cody and we have Gomez and we have Roscoe and we have Dixie and we have, the gangster, you know, Mr. Edwards. We've got all of these characters that have names and lines, and not only that, but they've got some sort of... And any other time, this would be a good thing. If you're writing a play, this is what you want. But they've
Sam
got all
is
these...
writing an angry letter to NBC as we speak right now, as we're recording this.
But it's just, there's just too much going on. There's too much going on, in my opinion, for a 47-minute teleplay to resolve in a satisfactory way. Not that it doesn't get resolved satisfactory, spoiler alert, but that I can't feel too invested in any one storyline. Mm-hmm. Am I supposed to care about the church? Am I supposed to care about the donut shop? Am I supposed to care about Sam getting his kneecaps busted? Am I supposed to care about Gomez training Sam for the fight so that he wins, so that Gomez doesn't have to be ashamed of his past anymore? Am I supposed to care about Al and his neighbor? What am I supposed to care about in this episode? And I know that I'm supposed to care about Sam getting the job done and leaping out. Mm. I just don't necessarily know what that means specifically for this episode. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem like they do either. Because I don't know if Sam's supposed to win the fight or lose the fight.
In this scene we find out, I think this is one of the first times where we see Al pull out the hand link and like really consult it for a good period of time to see like what happened in the original history.
Yeah.
But we find out like, Kid Cody threw the fight, Sister Angela never got her chapel, and the place where that chapel would have been built was home to some disreputable businesses, a mm-hmm. convenience store that had been robbed 5 times already in Al's present day.
Yeah, and there is that one scene that's really nice, too, where Sister Angela is showing Sam the outline of where everything is going to be.
Sure.
You know, this is going to be this, and this is going to be over here. So, I mean, there's definitely some emotional investment in that storyline, but it just seems to get cast aside in favor of all these other things that are going on. Mm-hmm. Not to rewrite the episode, but I could see the episode being more successful if you pared things down. Even if we got rid of Dixie. And I like Dixie. Mm-hmm. You know, I like Dixie in this episode, and I like what she brings to it. I just don't feel like I like it enough to say that it's necessary. Mm-hmm. Or, on the flip side of that, get rid of the nuns and have the story be about Sam trying to win enough money for he and his sweetheart to build a donut shop. You know, I mean, to me, there's just too much.
Too much going on. It's going to sound like a tangent, but I'll bring it back around. I watched the premiere episode of The Orville last week, Seth MacFarlane's new Star Trek series, and I posted a thing on and about it. I'm going to keep watching it, and the thing I posted is that it seems like Seth MacFarlane wanted to play Star Trek, Fox wanted your typical Seth MacFarlane show, and they met somewhere in the middle, and the middle just doesn't
quite hold together.
Work. Yeah. And one of my friends commented that supposedly, like, really around about the fourth episode, they figure out what that mix is. And someone else commented further that another writer TV personality has made the argument that in the ideal world, the producers of any television series should be able to go back and just burn to the ground the first 10 episodes of any series and do them over.
Sure. I totally get that. Especially, you know, being a Star Trek fan, like you're saying, you look at, you know, any of the series with the possible exception of Enterprise, which ends up being universally derided, but the first episode does pretty well, actually.
You know, I'm going to argue that 100 years from now, Enterprise is going to be considered one of the best series of Star Trek.
Maybe.
Time is going to prove me right.
There are some bad episodes.
There are some bad
episodes. I will say this, and I know I'm not going to make a lot of friends on this one probably, but I will say that the worst episodes of Enterprise are still better than the worst episodes of Voyager. The worst episodes of Voyager are some of the worst pieces of television I've ever seen in my entire life. Like, they're just bad.
And this is the first hate mail that Fate Wide Wheel ever got.
Hey, I'm a Niner. DS9 is the best iteration of Star Trek, in my opinion.
I still have that ahead of me. I have not watched that one yet.
But anyway, back
to Quantum Leap. So there's a lot of going on, in this particular episode. But by the end of this scene, we have this moment where Sam goes, hey, you're telling me everything that happened in the original history. I'm here. What happens if I win? Yeah. Which at the moment, I was like, oh, yeah, you're going to win? You're not going to win? Keep your left up.
Right.
And they have this nice little...
And it does. It plays into that last scene where Sam gets left in the dark, or Al, rather, gets left in the dark, and now all of a sudden, mm-hmm. you know, he's able to kind of, he's coaching Sam in spite of not being able to have been his coach during the training montage. He's kind of giving him some tips and, you know, and at the same time, it's sort of like, you're not going to win this fight. Like, come on, you know. Yeah.
But to go back to the Al's outfits.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Where as ugly as his gold jacket was in the beginning of the scene, his outfit in this scene is on point. It's like the white suit.
Yeah, the all white suit. Yeah. 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 With the red and orange tie.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and then, yeah, Sam at this point is more resolved than ever to win the fight because he doesn't want to leave Sister Angela hanging. Mm-hmm. Of course, Mr. Edwards comes in and tells him he's going to take a dive in the first round.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that.
That's happened, yeah. So now the next scene is we are at the church where Sam has gone to find Sister Angela, and we've come to find out that in the space between Mr. Edwards has shown up, has given the money to Sister Angela. So, and the thing is, rewatching this scene... We skipped over a previous scene. There was a second scene in the bar with Gomez and Kid Cody as Sam, where Mr. Edwards shows up and he's like, "Oh, like I hear you're really training for real. Like there's nothing worse than the rum dumb who gets religion."
Yes.
So Mr. Edwards knows that one, Cody is training seriously, and two, like he's established some kind of relationship or rapport with Sister Angela, and that's the scene where he comes in and says, "You're going to take the dive in the first round."
But he says it twice. That's the thing. Because he says it at one point, and Sam tells him he'll decide when he's going to take the dive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this is interesting because there is a running theme, and we're approaching this particular plot point, that I think Sam is starting to try to come up with a plan B.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what if I don't win the fight?
Yes.
And so that plan B, I feel like, is starting to sprout where Sam is just sort of like, I decide what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's his way of letting on that he's going to win the fight, but it's maybe Sam's way of hedging his bets and being like, I can't fall in round one. Maybe I fall later. I don't know. I could be way off base there. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's not this at all, but I just think that there is a plan B, and Sam has started to work on
absolutely
plan B.
So yeah, I skipped ahead. So we have the scene where we know that Sister Angela knows that he's supposed to take a dive.
Yes.
We have this heartfelt moment, this scene where Sam says, "Please don't give up on me.
Yeah.
Believe in me. I'm not the Kid Cody who did this." Early in the series, we have a lot of moments where in some way Sam tries to say, "I'm not who you think I am.
Yeah.
I'm not the Kid Cody who did this. I'm not whatever." And there's another episode coming up where he does the same thing.
And even in the pilot episode when, you know, he does it more to Al. I mean, the stuff he does with Peg is a little bit different, but when he's, you know, Tim Fox, when he's a baseball player, he's just like, I'm not a strikeout. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not him.
Absolutely. So we have this moment where he convinces Sister Angela to not give up on him. Then we have the scene in the bar where Sam tries to tell Mr. Edwards, like, "Hey, how about I tell you what to bet on?
Yeah.
Don't bet on me." He doesn't say what to bet on. They save that reveal until later, but he says, "Don't bet on me. I'm going to tell you what to bet on."
Yeah.
And then we cut to a scene with him and Dixie where Sam knows that they can get 20-1 betting the round, which is something that he had learned earlier from Mr. Edwards.
Yeah, and here's one of the this might be the worst Sam line in season one, hands down, because he's telling her to streak because of the plot point that we learned about earlier on the TV show with television where they talk about the streaker on the news. So he's like, you know, be the streaker, distract, etc.
This is the only way I can win the fight.
Right. The only way I can win the fight is if you do this. And she's not feeling good about that. Now, one thing that we should mention that we failed to earlier is that Dixie is indeed a topless dancer. That's what she does for a living.
Mm-hmm.
And Sam has a line. Because Dixie says, you know, something to the effect of, like, "I'm just a tramp," you know. Mm-hmm. And Sam's line is, "You're not a tramp. You're a stripper. That's a profession." And it just... I can't wrap my head around Dr. Sam Beckett saying that to a woman.
Again, early on in the series,
yes,
they don't know who Sam is. I don't think there's anything necessarily misogynistic about it.